Okay. Good afternoon. My name is Steve Riley. I am right now working for Riverbed Technology. I've been there for a couple of years. We specialize in lots of the interesting edge cases around long distance and high speed networking. Steelhead is our primary product. We've also made some investments in network visibility and operations. You might have seen recently we acquired OpNet, and we're also moving into the load balancer and web content optimization space as well with some acquisitions that we made about a year and a half or so ago. So anything around network and application performance is what's especially useful to us. Before I joined Riverbed, I was at Amazon Web Services for about a year and a half, where I spent most of my time researching and writing about cloud security, both from what it means for a provider to implement secure systems, as well as how do you talk to customers about cloud security and help them understand what the provider does and then what the customer might need to do on top of that. Before I was at Amazon, I was here. I was at Microsoft for about 11 years, three of those years in MCS, doing security consulting for the telco practice, and then for eight of those years, I was in the Trustworthy Computing Group. So the material that Keith had asked me to put together for this presentation reflects kind of a combination of some of the things that we were doing at Amazon to talk about cloud architecture and how do you build applications so that they take full advantage of the features that the cloud provider might give you, along with some of the experience that I gained working with customers around how to secure those applications. We'll talk about what it means to understand security when you no longer own the infrastructure, which is kind of an interesting dilemma to try to get your brain wrapped around. And then I'll wrap up the last part of this three-part presentation on how the notion of IT operations is going to change in the era of cloud. So kind of three broad themes that we'll go through here. If you have any questions or comments on some of the material that I'm going through, feel free to interrupt. I don't try to do this stuff very formally. If you want to argue or debate, that's fine too. I'll let you go on for a while, give you enough rope to hang yourself, let you know why you're wrong. All the rest of us will laugh, and then we'll move on. That's cool. And the presentation style, by the way, they asked me for my slides. I don't build slides to, I build slides to support me. It's not the other way around. Most of what matters is what's coming out of my mouth, not what's on the screen. You'll see as I start going through the material. So lesson number one is all about optimizing cloud development. This is a very, very quick overview of something that could actually be done with a series of white papers. And believe it or not, you can download a series of white papers that talk exactly about this from aws.amazon.com/architecture. What's interesting, though, about the material is it is not necessarily specific to AWS. Now, those papers will use AWS language when they talk about instances and elastic load balancer and simple queuing service and things like that. It doesn't mean, though, that the architecture principles apply only to AWS. They will apply to just about any kind of cloud, more so for infrastructure cloud, maybe a little bit less for platform-type clouds, and probably not much at all for software-as-a-service clouds such as Salesforce.com, but people don't go to Salesforce usually to write applications. So you can take what you learn here and perhaps change the vocabulary as necessary, but the ideas are the same. And they all have kind of the same theme, and that theme is scalability. And what's interesting about this, about moving workloads into something like Azure or something like Amazon Web Services, is all of the prior constraints you had around hardware availability, around storage space, around network utilization kind of evaporate. And when you don't have to worry about 6 months to get a machine and, oh, now the machine isn't big enough anymore, that completely changes the way you think about producing applications. You're not really hardware constrained so much anymore. If you need more resources, you throw more hardware or virtual hardware at it, right? But the beauty of this is it's only when needed. And this is one of the things that I think is really important. And Werner Vogels talks a lot about this. He talks about the false cloud. And I know he does it to get reporters all upset and riled up. But think about it for a minute. Just because you sprinkle some virtualization across your existing in-house infrastructure doesn't mean you get to call it a cloud. And furthermore, if you're still paying for it when you turn it off, is it still a cloud? There's some interesting debate yet to be had around this notion. And I think one of the key elements of cloud computing is what NIST calls self-service on demand. And metered billing. You bring it up when you need it, you turn it off when you don't need it, and you don't pay for it when you aren't using it anymore. These are essential attributes that define cloud. And if you're missing these attributes, then I think you've just got a virtualized data center. So I'd like to go through these architecture lessons now. There's seven of them. And like I said, it's pretty high level. The idea is just to get you to think about application development in a different way than you might be accustomed to, because the way you're accustomed to arose from the existence of constraints. First of all, assume that everything fails. Now, yeah, of course, an Amazon guy or an ex-Amazon guy is naturally going to say this because Amazon's always failing, right? They're always in the news, after all. One definition of news is something that doesn't happen very often. How many on-premise data centers every day experience failures that maybe cost, you know, business loss? More than you could count. Every day, thousands of people die on highway collisions. You don't hear about airplanes falling out of the sky very much because it doesn't happen very often. But when an airplane falls out of the sky, it makes the news. But the people who die in car crashes, as sad as it is, it doesn't make the news. So I personally, even though I'm not working there anymore, I would have no problem putting my entire business IT workload, if I ran an IT shop, there now, or Azure, or Rackspace, or any of the really well-done clouds. I'm confident in many of them. Yep?
Question.
Yeah?
You look at Amazon data centers, or Azure,
yep.
And compare them to enterprise data centers, there's a big difference in how they do it, as I'm sure you know, Steve.
Yep.
But, you know, in enterprise data centers, you've got via clustering with VMware or Hyper-V, you've got servers that cost tens of thousands, you've got SANs. They work very hard to not fail. They strive for five nines.
Yes.
Whereas when you look at an Amazon or an Azure data center, mm-hmm. the level of effort to make the hardware reliable is much lower. There are three nines, three and a half nines. No VM clustering, no SANs. The reality is that those guys expect you to build apps differently than we have it on premises. And so if I'm building a new app, I totally agree with you.
Mm-hmm.
But what you just said is that you'd be willing to move all your existing stuff,
yep.
built as single instances, stateful instances, five nine data centers into
Okay, so you caught me. Let me say this. I would be willing to construct a new IT set of new IT workloads using the principles I'm going to be telling you in AWS. Would I rsync or xcopy my existing stateful VMs into AWS and try to run those applications unchanged? No. And since we're talking about this, let me give you an example of where an attempt actually made this very difficult. When I was still there, Amazon IT embarked on a project to move on-premise Exchange and SharePoint into AWS. That was really, really hard. They succeeded, but there were a couple of things that are like edge cases that made the project especially difficult. They decided they wanted to BitLocker all the data drives, and Server 2008 at the time, if you were BitLockering something not a C drive, then it wouldn't automatically unlock when the machine would boot, right? You had to have a human present. So if the virtual machine would boot up, you know, reboot for one reason or another, all the, you know, the D drive and the E drive or wherever the Exchange store was wouldn't unlock unless somebody were there to type the key. So I put together a quick script that would use the, I'm forgetting now because I, what is the, service built into Windows that allows you to grab cryptography keys? I've lost the name of it. Sorry, guys. I've kind of gone to the dark side. I run Unix on everything now, and some of these things I've kind of forgotten. But I wrote a script that would use the machine's key to unlock a file that contained the BitLocker key that we would then feed to BitLocker using the manage BDE script, right? So we worked a way around that. There is a white paper, actually, that Amazon has that describes their migration of Exchange into SharePoint into AWS from on-premise. And I think the high-level lesson to learn from that exercise is existing apps aren't going to move easily. Some can, but it's difficult. But now back to my original point. If I were to start over IT, I'd have no problem using any of these well-built clouds. Now, let's get to this idea, too, about lower hardware reliability. I don't think that's necessarily a design goal, but maybe because there's so much redundancy, five nines of an individual piece of hardware is no longer necessary. I've had a virtual machine running on AWS since the day I started there, and it hasn't yet come down, right? And so that would have been July of 2009. Now, I don't know what they're doing. I know that the virtual machine has been moved, but it's not been stopped, right? And so maybe they're using K-Splice to update the underlying host operating system. I'm not sure if that's the case, but I would guess that that's what they're doing. So there's some interesting things happening. Think about the S3 storage service. You put an object in, we're getting off this, but it's useful, right? And some of what I'm saying now is gonna apply later, so I might skip, but it's in the context since we have the question on the floor. You put an object in Amazon S3, and they will tell you they make multiple copies of it and store it in multiple separate physical locations. It's three and three, if you care. So if a disk drive dies, the storage fabric detects this. It raises an alert. Somebody who is allowed to go into that data center gets a service ticket that lasts long enough for them to enter the data center for that period of time. If it's the data center in Oregon, they're also US citizens. That's where the ITAR region is. They take out that drive, throw it in the grinder, put a new drive in. Meanwhile, the storage service has already replicated your object to somewhere else. So it always maintains those three copies. Now, at the logical level, you can see a file because it's constructed. The individual nodes that are spread across multiple drives, by the way, the individual blocks, contain your customer ID. But at the physical level, the data on the disk drive is sufficiently obfuscated that even if you put it on Encase, you can't really construct anything meaningful from it. Because if you're looking to build a 5 megabyte PowerPoint file, the drive that you got might have only one block of that file. The rest of it is spread across thousands or tens of thousands of disk drives. So to some degree, the level of indirection and obfuscation that exists in their infrastructure is such that you may not need to encrypt everything, although we're going to talk about that a little bit later. But I'm just giving you kind of an insight here that sometimes isn't always visible to people on the outside. And while I don't know whether Azure Storage Service is built exactly the same as S3, when I look at the way the APIs work and when I look at the pricing, they certainly seem familiar, or they certainly seem similar. So many of the same techniques are probably still in use, right? That's why a lot of this stuff, I've really grown to like it, I've grown to trust it, but it does mean you have to kind of change the way you think about it. Thanks for the question. So if we get, now we, if we assume failure then, of course, and then we design backwards, it isn't because the cloud provider gets more money out of you since you'll be running more instances. Everybody thinks that's the reason why the cloud providers tell you to run multiple instances in multiple regions is because they get more money out of you. No, this is the way you really get global resiliency. I like that idea a lot. Now, one of the challenges is that the load balancers that often come free or at low cost from your cloud provider, they don't give you global resiliency. They'll give you regional resiliency. So you might need to rely on some third-party load balancer if you want true global resiliency. That's just something to remember as you're looking at the architectures and the capabilities of the various services. But it is a big planet. So take advantage of the fact that it's a big planet and put your stuff in multiple places. Get it closer to the end users and rely on some kind of back-end synchronization, for example. Think about your databases. Does all data need to be always consistent, or can some of it be eventually consistent? Now you can think about prioritizing what gets replicated first and how fast it gets replicated. The second thing to think about when you're designing for the cloud is this notion of loose coupling. And by loose coupling, I mean mechanisms such as a queuing service or a message service that allow your applications to be tolerant of variance. If you have a workload that does something and then needs to send it to another workload that's waiting for it. What if connectivity breaks? Or what if the workload that's waiting for it actually isn't ready yet, but there's no way for the workload that's ready to send something can't wait for the other guy to finish, right? So this is where you start to see the cloud providers beginning to incorporate as an element of their design things like queuing services and message buses. So you incorporate those in between the two workloads. So when the first, you know, when Alice is done with her part, she just dumps it onto a queue. And then when Bob is ready, he can pick it up off of the queue. We did an interesting experiment where, and this is again back when I was in AWS, we wanted to build a mechanism for people to upload and transcode videos. Now, it's something very interesting if you've ever actually worked in taking like an MP2 or MPEG-2 stream in an AVI container and try to compress that into, I don't know, AVC inside an MP4 container. It takes a long time, and you can't predict it because it depends on how much motion is in the video and what the color depth is and things like that. So the first design was a box that would accept an input from the internet and immediately start transcoding that thing. But we found that that was not a very good design because when the CPU is busy doing transcoding, it actually slows down the virtual NIC's ability to absorb traffic. So we created separate farms. We created an upload farm, and we created a transcode farm. We didn't put any queuing in between. As soon as the thing finished uploading, it would pick a random box and send it over there for transcoding. Well, that random box might be busy, and it just says, sorry, I can't take you right now, and the uploaded file will get dropped on the floor. Again, okay, not thinking right, what should we do? Let's put a message bus in the middle. So the message bus is able to tell the uploading farm and the transcoding farm which machine is idle and which machine is busy and where to send it next, or wait. So a lot of interesting things here. And in almost all of these examples that I'm giving you throughout this section, there is a document somewhere on AWS, usually on that slash architecture page, where you can learn a little bit more about this if you want to. The point number three, this notion of implementing elasticity. I already alluded to this a little bit earlier. Don't ever assume that a machine is always going to be there. Assume that sometimes it won't be there. But as you start to think about how to make sure that machines are there when they need to be there, you might want to think about mechanisms that allow you to have dynamic configurations. At the beginning, people would build VMs from what's called an AMI, or a definition file that this is how, you know, this is what an email server VM should look like when you instantiate one, and this is what a database server should look like when you instantiate one. More now, what we're seeing is people begin to use scripting mechanisms, whether they're full commercialized ones like the templates you'd get from RightScale, or roll your own recipes. Puppet and Chef seem to be the two that are really popular for this, where you tell the recipe what the server should be when you call it. Okay, recipe, you're going to build a database server now. Or recipe, you're going to build a web server now. And it makes it a lot easier to change the components because you just change what goes into the recipe. And if you want to change what the version of Apache that's in your next web server, you don't actually have to go change all of your AMIs, those images that instances come from. Instead, you just tell the recipe to pull the tar.gz from someplace else, and now it has the newer version of Apache. So it does reduce the amount of workload required. There's fewer things you have to maintain, and the servers actually build themselves a little bit faster this way, we found too. Step four, build security in. The bad guys, they are everywhere. I'm going to talk more about security as actually a separate section in the presentation. So I don't really want to spend a whole lot of time on this now, other than a couple of the simple reminders that, that's actually something I did see. I did not stage that to then take a picture of it. Because there's bad security all over the place, right? One of the things that you can generally rely on, though, is the bad security is not built into the cloud. In every case that I know of during the time I was at Amazon, if a customer's workload got hacked, it's because the customer's application had vulnerabilities. It wasn't because somebody found a vulnerability in the service itself. So you have to think about where you're placing your security guards, for example, and what really matters. Maybe there's a feature in the service you could take advantage of that you weren't taking advantage of before. And let me give you an example of how you might be able to do this. Think of a classic three-tier architecture. You've got a web tier, you've got a business logic tier, and you've got the database tier. You're going to put all three of those in AWS. Now, which of those tiers actually should accept inbound traffic from the internet? The web tier, right? Okay. Now, how do you dictate that the web tier can take inbound traffic from the internet, but the other two tiers shouldn't? Well, I wouldn't expect you all to have an answer because you probably are spending more time in Azure. But again, like I said on the onset, these same principles apply. I just use the language that I'm more familiar with here. There is the notion of instance security groups. It's a simple, stateful firewall that lives outside the virtual machine. You define the traffic patterns that are allowed to enter the virtual machine. So for the web tier, I would create a security group called web security group that allows inbound traffic from the internet on usually, what, 80 and 443, right? For the business logic tier, I would create a security group likely with two sets of rules. One set of rules says inbound traffic from the machines in the web tier. See, I don't actually have to write DNS names. I don't have to write IP addresses. I give it the name of the other group. And the Cloud Fabric automatically takes care of understanding how to direct that traffic. The other set of rules I might put in the security group for the web, for the business logic tier, would be SSH and RDP from the corpnet. Because I still might want to manage that thing remotely. So I might allow that, right? And then in the database tier, I'm going to write two sets of rules again. One that allows the servers in the business logic tier to make inbound connections, and one that allows SSH and RDP from the corpnet, and possibly from the database vendor, depending on which database backend you might be using. So there is a way, very simple, to build three-tier architectures on what is presented to you as a flat network without tiers built in. You are actually assigning the tiers using nothing more than a set of rules. You can do this all via APIs, as a matter of fact. So if you think sort of like in the beginning when we said assume things will break and design backwards, when you're considering how to secure an application in the cloud, assume that there exist threats, and again, you design backwards. Think about how the application might be abused, and then implement security controls that make it less likely to be abused. Actually, you know what? This kind of reminds me of a story I want to tell you. Thinking like a bad guy. My son, he's 16 now. So 2 years ago, when he was 14, over summer, he went to a Java camp at UW. They did computer geeky camp for high school or middle school kids for a week, and he had the choice of learning Java or C, and he wanted to learn Java. If I knew now, or if I knew back then what I know now about how bad Java is, and I would have pushed him the other direction, but anyway. The exercise lasted a week. Friday was exhibition day when parents could come see what the kids did. So I took a look at his program. It was a simple text-based blackjack game. I looked at the code, never enough comments. It's always going to be the first thing you notice. But the code was pretty sound, although I noticed that he was assuming that all input would be valid. So I run the game. It says, welcome to blackjack. Press 1 to play. Press 2 to end. I typed 47 and hit enter. The Eclipse crashed, or the application crashed into Eclipse, and it was running as root. So I type rm-rfe/ and put my finger over the enter key, and the proctor of the class is like, what are you doing? I'm teaching my son a lesson. I didn't hit the enter button. But you know, he's like, well, why did you type 47? The program didn't say 47. This is my 14-year-old asking me this. And I said, Dylan, not everyone is going to do only what your software expects. Well, who would ever do that? Son, I built a career out of finding those guys. So, you know, it's one of those good moments, right? And we actually talked about that on the bus on the way home, about how people attack software by trying to force it to do things it's not supposed to do. So the main lesson here is think about that. Anticipate that. Build that kind of resiliency into your applications, and you won't be on the news. Lesson number 5, don't fear constraints. And remember, I kind of began the talk about this notion of we always lived under constraints because we never imagined that there was anything other than that. Well, in this new model, and again, regardless of which cloud you're using, a lot of these just evaporate. If you think you need more RAM, maybe you actually could use more VMs instead of more RAM, more parallel processing, right? If you think you need more IOPS, perhaps you might actually get better performance if you, and I can't say in this word, shard that data, right? It's close to a biological function. That's disgusting. But anyway, how can you spread the data across multiple devices instead of just getting faster I/O? Did your server die? I love this. Kill it. You have a limited amount of time. You can spend a lot of time trying to investigate why the application or the VM crashed, or you just say, give me a new one. I tell you, you know, when people are paying for this kind of stuff, I just want to say, give me a new one. I don't want to spend a lot of time trying to diagnose something like this. Now, if they keep crashing, then that's probably a bug in your recipe or in your app. Go fix that. One-off crashes, don't worry about it. What if you need more performance? Well, think about some additional things that might help you instead of just getting that raw VM. So earlier I talked about adding VMs if you think you need more RAM. That's useful. But another way to get more performance is to actually think about what extra elements of the cloud architecture might I be able to use. Memcached is a great way for increasing web server performance. So you might think about putting a Memcached instance in front of your web servers if that will work for your architecture. Lesson number 6, think parallel. Kind of alluded to this earlier. But because you get to use so many VMs and so many disk drives, you get to do lots of stuff next to each other. And you can start running experiments. And you can have version 1.0 of your app in production with live customer data. You can X-copy that thing over into another area. Keep that live customer data because it's better than any synthetic data you can make to do testing. Now you've got a copy of your production. The production app stays untouched. It's making money. You've got this copy that you can use to develop version 1.5 or version 2.0. When it works and you've debugged it and you've tested it and you've got buy-in to all the new features and you've maybe rolled it out to a sample set of your customers and they love everything, guess what? Tell your load balancer to start draining all the connections to people in version 1.0. When all those connections are drained, in the middle of the night, remap your DNS over to version 2.0, and you're done. And now all that stuff you had for version 1.0, log into the admin console, terminate, you're done. Do that with a bunch of physical machines in a data center where somebody else actually is responsible for buying the box, and yet somebody else is responsible for putting it in the rack, and that guy probably has a lot of difficulty distinguishing the server from the box it came in. Right. So you can think about ways to decompose these jobs and really how you can maybe not share anything at all. I talked about this a little bit earlier, this notion of not only machines everywhere, but storage options everywhere too. You know, all cloud providers give you storage choices. Not to mention an essentially infinite amount. Right? I mean, every once in a while, if you're using AWS in US East 1, which is the region in Virginia, you might get a resource unavailable error message. The reason you're going to get that error message is because that region is the crufty old region that was the laboratory experiment that ended up becoming AWS. So there's a lot of Band-Aids and Scotch tape in US East 1. Don't put anything there. It's also the one that keeps appearing in the news if you pay attention, right? Put your stuff in California. Oregon's good. Singapore's good. Europe is good. Brazil's good. All the new ones are designed really, really well. I would just say don't use Virginia anymore. But the reality is, not only do you have what appears to be an infinite storage amount, but you've got a variety of storage types. You've got block storage. You've got file storage. There's a variety of database types. There's a very interesting kind of database in AWS called SimpleDB, which is just nothing more than HTML exposed attribute value table, right? It's there's no bounds on either dimension of the table. And if you're a really favored customer, that means you buy like reserved instances and you use a lot of AWS. If your database crashes for some reason, remember SimpleDB is nothing more than HTTP gets and puts. You can call them on the phone and say, would you please replay my log? And you could get 30 days of your database back just by replaying logs. Yeah. What's that? Well, you know, the only way I knew that happened is because one day I wandered up to the 11th floor when they used to be over in the hospital over on the hill, and I was watching a guy actually do this. What's all this stuff scrolling up on your screen? Oh, I'm replaying somebody's SimpleDB log because they killed their own database. We don't do this for everybody, only people who know to call and ask for it. There you go. Now you know. So part number one, architecture lessons over. The conclusion of this is something that maybe isn't so radical anymore, but it was when I started giving this presentation about a year ago. Servers are disposable horsepower. And when you think of them in this way, how does it change the assumptions you used to have about the availability of resources? Infrastructure comes and it goes. It's, you know, to modify a phrase that is maybe not so in vogue anymore, but it's all about the data now. So how are you going to secure this stuff? We already talked about application security and taking advantage of a security feature built into many clouds. I now want to take a slightly different approach to thinking about security, because the question that hasn't been answered yet is, well, how secure is that cloud? Remember that there essentially is a trade-off that you're making. If you own everything, everything is on-premise, you are responsible for the security of everything, from the concrete all the way to the sky. As you start moving into these different cloud models, what's, you know, the scope of what you can secure reduces, right? In an infrastructure type cloud, you don't get to choose the physical security. In a platform type cloud, you don't get to choose the operating system security. In a software cloud, you don't get to choose the platform security, or even the application security in many cases, right? So these are trade-offs, but it doesn't mean they're bad trade-offs. It's just understand that there exists this trade-off curve. That's all you need to remember, right? But it's still, there's that lingering question, can I trust that hardware that I don't own with my data? This is what I'd like to think about a little while now. The traditional model that we've all grown up with on how to know whether something is secure is location-based. You might not have thought about it that way, but it's location-based. I know where my stuff is in that museum right there, right? Think about that one for a minute. Yeah, I'm sure you can see the brand, right? It says IBM, and you can even see the number 360, and everything in that room was made by IBM, including the table, including the protocol, you know, SNA. I mean, it was all done, right? But the point is, you would make certain assumptions based on the notion of location. Oops, location implies ownership. Ownership means control. If something is here and it is mine, then I can say that it is secure. Therefore, by definition, things that are not here are not mine, and they are not secure. Yes, this is how security officers for the most of their career have thought. Now, they don't like to be told that their, you know, highly refined processes and thinking styles can be distilled into something like that. But believe me, you know, I've been there for many, many years, so I know that's basically what it's all about. Although, if you were to actually ask me outside of this room, is it really that simple, I'd have to give you a no, because otherwise it would seem like any monkey could do security, right? This arose from the natural state of the way networks were built. Networks were built with perimeters. Perimeters allowed you to put a mark around things that are trusted. And everything inside that circle is owned. It's local. And then everything outside that circle is untrusted because it's something else. It's the other guy. It's remote. I don't know anything about it. I have a question to ask you. How many of you have only one device still? You're the odd man out. All the rest of you have more than one, right? How many terabytes of storage space are in this room right here? I would be interested in knowing. Here's another question. This might be your primary access device. This might be your primary creation and consumption device. Is it your primary storage device? It's not mine. Guess what? I could lose this. I could, you know, somebody could steal it. I don't care. I might be upset because I'm out, you know, the few $100 guy's got to buy a new one, but it doesn't matter to me because it's not the authoritative location for my data anymore. We have an interesting diverging moment occurring here now, where the things we use to create and consume data are not the things we use to store data. This is something kind of new. A lot of people say, ah, cloud ain't nothing new. Well, I think it actually is new for this reason. And when data is being created in one place or consumed in another place, but yet stored and computed in yet another place, security that's based on location starts to feel like it's losing its utility. So what I propose is that we give up location-based security controls. We give up the notion that we can measure whether something is secure or not based on location. And guess what? This is actually, you know, like to people in the generation a couple of years, you know, a couple lower than us, this is the world they live in right now, right? It isn't anything new for them. I had a very interesting experience last week. I went to go chat with a couple of folks at Snohomish PUD for a while. And they're for a municipal power company, they are amazingly forward thinking. And they have two things they want to try to get done very, very quickly. They want to figure out the best way to do bring your own device. Actually, they don't even want to do device management anymore. They want to give people $1,500, go to Best Buy, knock yourself out. But they're doing this because they want to make sure that they are an attractive employer for the next generation of candidates. Now, this is something I've actually been talking about for some time now. What do IT shops in the 21st century need to do to make IT fun to work or to make the organization a fun place to come? You know, 22-year-olds are going to come with a completely different set of expectations about the work environment than you had when you were 22 years old. We can argue until we're dead about whether those expectations are useful or not, but the fact is they're going to have them. So let's accommodate it, at least in some way, right? And it was really refreshing to hear these guys say that they've already realized they need to do this. How do we do it in a way that protects the business? Also, when you think about location-based security, what does it mean when your backpack is filled with stuff like that? Right? That's my backpack from when I was in MCS, I mean, a long, long time ago, right? I don't think I even have that PlayStation anymore. When you consider that you are always connected now, I have a question to ask you. When you're on that plane and the plane doesn't have Wi-Fi and you can't be connected to anything, deep, deep down in places people prefer not to pretend exist, you really feel kind of funky, don't you? Everybody loves to say, oh yeah, I love being disconnected, it feels great. No, you're like, you can't wait because I know, I travel all the time, and I see people coming off airplanes like this, right? We're all going to identify each other by the tops of our heads someday, not by our faces. In 2009, and the reason why I go back this far is because I haven't yet been able to find another source or another report that I think is as good as this one. This outfit, you might have read some stuff by them, did some research and determined that human beings across the entire planet are creating an exabyte of new data every day. That's an exabyte. One of these days, I'll figure out how many times that goes from the Earth to the moon if you stack pennies. But that's a lot. That's new every day. And where is it going? It's going to these places. Really. You know, your Gmail is cloud. Your Facebook is cloud. It's all cloud. That's where it's going. So obviously, a lot of people trust it. So we need a new model. A new model that is not based on outdated notions of location and being able to point to something and saying that that is mine. What is this new model? This new model still does answer the question, who controls? Because that's what you need to know as stuff is flowing across the pipes that litter the land and goes here. You still need to ask the question, who controls the data? Well, the way you answer the question, who controls the data, is you look for cloud providers that have certain attributes. One of them is good, strong service level agreements. And this is the one thing that I will continue to bash Amazon and Azure and Rackspace and everybody about until they get serious about this stuff. If you're going to trust them with your business, they need to do more than give you a dollar off your next bill if something goes wrong, wonky. That's just not the right way to do it. I'm sorry. In many cases, an instance hour looks a lot like a book. But this is one example of where selling you an instance hour for 8.5 cents does not look like a book. There needs to be a lot more enterprise thinking around how to deliver this stuff. And I'm not seeing it yet. With one notable exception, Azure. Actually, Azure gets it better than most other cloud providers. As far as enterprise thinking around this, they're a little bit ahead. And the hint that I'm leaving you with is, if you, any Microsoft employees in this room here? Okay, you guys, you can slaughter AWS on this alone. All right, I'm not kidding you. There are customers out there of Amazon Web Services right now who use it because it's there and it's cheap and they can run Windows workloads in it, but they're not very happy with this. Beat them here, you will.
Steve, what are you thinking of here? What is the thing that Azure is better at with SLAs than Amazon today?
It's kind of a soft, gooey thing more than a hard, actual bit of numbers. In a lot of cases, people who want to put stuff in a cloud, especially an infrastructure type cloud, because they, you know, and this was more difficult before the persistent VM workload came into Azure, right? So it's much easier for Microsoft to capture some business from Amazon now than it was before this new feature in Azure came about. But what I should be more accurate what I'm saying here is that customers trust Microsoft for this stuff more than they trust Amazon. And so you can capitalize on that customer trust by actually implementing some good, strong service level agreements with some degree of financial backing that make it more attractive to customers than just the fact that it's a Microsoft-branded cloud. To a certain degree, some Windows customers are going to move back to Azure just because they don't want to be on Amazon. But if you can give them a more attractive reason, and here's an example. If a customer can identify that this server goes down for an hour, costs me $1 million, there's actually organizations out there right now who will sell you virtual machine insurance. I hate to say this because when you think of insurance, you think of that slimy guy who shows up in the middle of dinner and wants to sell you a whole life policy, right? That's not what this is about. What this is about is and Cloud Insure is one website that does this. I know the principals who started this company. They actually have found insurers, Lloyd's of London is one of them, who will assume the risk of mission-critical workloads in third-party infrastructures, and if they go down, you can make a claim. Now, is there something perhaps that Azure could do in conjunction with these guys so that you can help customers understand that you've got their back to a certain degree financially, but in reality, you're outsourcing that to somebody else who's willing to take that risk. So there are some very interesting things that you can do here. I didn't really intend this to be a secret, how do you beat your competitor competition, but I've been at both, so, you know, hey, you can benefit from that. I like a lot of what I see technically with Azure. I'd like to see the marketing get better. And you do that through improved competition. And here's just one aspect that you can use to do that with. The next thing that makes for good security controls are auditable security standards. Now, by this, I simply mean if a customer wants to know how up-to-date your ISO 27001 certification is, tell them. And don't just stop there, but tell them that you use the ISO 27002 control matrix as well. 27001 is kind of useless without knowing what the control matrixes were for the comparison. Now you can compare clouds against each other, or customers can compare your cloud against their own infrastructure and find out why the cloud is better. So this also matters. Don't try to be secretive about this stuff. When AWS got its first SAS 70 certificate, all they wanted to do on the website was say, we have a SAS 70 certification. And I'm like, no one's going to buy that. You gotta show them the control matrix. Right? Let them know what the auditors found. You don't have to tell them the bad things auditors found and fixed, but you could give them the list of the stuff the auditors looked at. Here is where I also like to talk about data center tours. There's a reason that Amazon does not offer data center tours. Rackspace does. I think it's a mistake. Even well-meaning customers will trip and fall into racks. And that could cause an outage, right? Bad guys will take your tour, and they'll memorize shift rotation patterns. They'll memorize the locations of video cameras. Right? There's risk involved in these things. So I think not having tours is a good thing, but the substitute for that is regular updated audit statements where you have the auditing company like Ernst & Young or PricewaterhouseCoopers, you know, take their statements and make them public. That's the substitute for data center tours. Finally, there is a place for encryption and digital signatures. Now, when I first started talking about this, I would only say encryption, and I would say that could solve all of your problems and you should encrypt everything. And then, you know, I started to think about this a little bit more and I've modified it. First of all, you don't need to encrypt most things because, you know, I gave you a little hint earlier about how data is really stored in these infrastructures and how stuff is spread out so much that the likelihood of an attacker being able to assemble something useful is pretty minimal anyway. Nevertheless, if you're worried about the cloud provider themselves, you know, you will want to encrypt something in that case, or you might have a regulatory reason. If you're storing healthcare data, HIPAA says you got to encrypt, so you're going to do that. Be wary of provider-offered encryption services, though. This is the classic Fox versus Hen House problem. And when I was at Amazon, at a conference one time, I floated the idea of simple encryption service. And I got slapped down for that because I had no idea it was actually in the pipeline as a product that people were going to come out with. I was just inventing it, but it turns out it was on somebody's roadmap somewhere. Yes, you can have Amazon generate an encryption key for you, and they'll escrow your key for you as well. All of those keys are stored and encrypted by a master key. What happens if something, you know, disastrous happens to the master key? I don't like this idea at all. I would rather go to some other cloud for my keys, or maybe I'll keep the keys on-premise, right? But as long as you maintain some form of isolation between the encryption keys and the data itself, I'm happy with that. And the reason why I've added the notion of digital signatures to this thing is because if you take a step back for a moment and think about the evolution of attacks, the security people love to talk about triangles, and the CIA triangle means a lot. And I don't mean the agency in DC, I mean the confidentiality, integrity, availability thing. Really, you should turn that around. It's It's ACI. Availability, confidentiality, integrity. And the reason why I like to do it that way is because that's the order bad guys have marched through during the course of history. Remember many, many years ago when February of 2000, I believe it was, when large parts of the internet just disappeared for a few hours? ZNet, CDNet, eBay, CNN, a number of sites went away. MSN was targeted, but actually resisted the attack because all Microsoft infrastructures have the right rules in their firewalls to block denial of service attacks. That was a 17-year-old kid from Canada. He called himself Mafia Boy, and he just issued a bunch of DOS attacks against routers. Gets in IRC and starts crowing about how good he is. Look at me, I brought down the internet. IRC, for those of you who don't know, is Internet Relay Chat. It's authenticated. You know where all the source traffic is coming from, and it's not encrypted. So the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, I guess they got on their horses, and went to his house where he was living with his mom. Of course, he's only 17, in Toronto, and bam, bam, bam. And he served a little bit of time in jail for that. That was an attack against availability. We fixed that with network rules and firewalls and stuff like that. Then the bad guys moved to attacks against confidentiality. They want to steal your data and give it to somebody else or sell it to somebody else. So we fixed that with encryption, right? The bad guy has your data. He doesn't have your key. Means he doesn't have your data. Now the bad guys are looking to make a difference. We're seeing attacks against integrity now. Bad guys are being paid by your competitors to break in to something, you, and maliciously modify your data. What kinds of erroneous business decisions will you make based on maliciously modified data? Possibly decisions that actually help your competitors beat you. And you solve this with digital signatures, which is a hash of the interesting object that you then encrypt, right? So these are complementary techniques, and I believe they make sense to use them together. So with this idea in mind, what we're talking about is redefining how we measure control, how we know that something is secure. When we don't own the infrastructure, but we still own the data. Guess what? You've already been doing this with your internet pipes. How many of you still use private leased line WAN links as opposed to the internet, right? Everybody uses the internet with VPNs now because it's cheaper. You have given up ownership of the infrastructure, the pipe, but it doesn't mean that AT&T and Quest or whoever now owns your data, right? CenturyLink. You still own the data. The service provider is giving you service level agreements. They're giving you auditable standards, and you're using, guess what? Encryption and digital signatures on every single datagram that's going over the pipe. Apply that same logic that you're already used to the compute and the storage as well. It isn't new. It's just done in a new spot. That's all. Oh, and there's one other thing that I think is perhaps an interesting thought exercise as we wrap up this section. In the traditional model of location-based security and, you know, all of the important stuff sitting down in the basement where you know it is and you can point to it, that guy worked for you. That guy is your enterprise administrator. He knows the combination to the safe where you keep all the little USB fobs that have all your keys on them, right? I don't like that guy working for me. In the new model, much of this is now being handled by the cloud provider who can be characterized as a disinterested third party. They don't know much about you. And frankly, they're not all that interested in what you have. But what they're very, very interested in is making sure that you stay and in making sure that the platforms they're providing for you are unattractive to bad guys to either attack or launch attacks from. So they actually have a lot more interest in this than many enterprise IT security folks do. I like this idea of the disinterested third party. Also, cloud security is scalable in a way that enterprise IT security just isn't. They've got full-time people who do nothing but this. Everything is automated, so you get the humans out because humans are what make vulnerabilities, not code. Most vulnerabilities are configuration mistakes, not code mistakes. And it does then make us wonder, what's the actual answer to this question? How about we let General Keith Alexander, chief of the U.S. Cyber Command, weigh in. In testimony to Congress, he actually said, I'm not all that worried about it. I don't stay awake at night worrying about the security of cloud computing. What he does question is the promised economic benefits. I think that's kind of interesting. But for all but the most sensitive workloads, General Alexander is very happy to put most of the U.S. government in public clouds. I think that means a lot of enterprises could be too. Another interesting idea is this notion of graceful degradation with uncertainty. And kind of where does that come from? It comes from getting away from thinking about this kind of security, which goes by another name, and instead thinking about how do biological systems protect themselves. You are under attack right now. Microorganisms are trying to eat you alive, but yet there are many, many systems in your body that detect and repel invasion. It's going on every moment of your life. There is some interesting research happening right now in the information security and data protection fields that are looking at ways to adopt what biological systems do for health maintenance and seeing what we might be able to learn and get out of these old castle and moat style thinking for protecting information. I'm really interested to see where this goes. Last thing about cloud security is it really is a partnership, especially when you think about compliance. Physical security is now free. You get it. It comes, well, it's not exactly free. It's built into that instance hour, right? But it's part of what you get. You don't have to worry about physical security anymore. Network security becomes easier. You don't have to write all these router ACLs anymore. You just worry about the instance firewalls for your particular virtual machines. You still have to worry about application security, however. But guess what? Not only do you have to worry about less, to the degree that cloud providers pursue these certifications, you get to do a neat thing called compliant by inclusion. If the cloud provider is PCI DSS level 1 compliant, that means that now what's in scope for you is not concrete to the sky because the provider has already done concrete to the hypervisor. What's in scope for you is less. It's less work for you to be PCI DSS level 1 compliant now in a PCI compliant cloud. You only have to worry about the VM on up. And the PCI Standards Council will acknowledge this. And you can provide to your auditor this statement, and it is allowed. So getting that is really challenging for the providers. But you all get to benefit from it as a customer of them. Now, part three, how do you optimize cloud operations? This is kind of the shortest section of the talk. I would actually like to develop this one a little bit more, but I just haven't yet. But I think it's interesting to start thinking about what does this mean. In many ways, the cloud is a kind of forcing function. It's causing IT to completely rethink the way it delivers services. Roles change. You know, that guy who takes a server out of boxes and puts it in the rack, that role is going to go away. He's going to need to find something new to do. There are no more buggy whip manufacturers in the United States. The good ones figured out how to build automobile starters. This is just what happens as technology marches on, right? People need to acquire new skills. IT shops need to help their people find new skills. Make it welcoming. You can learn here. This is the best way you can eliminate fear. In a brewery in Belgium is a museum containing that power generator. Why? Well, because 100 years ago, there was no public electric utility in Belgium. You need electrons to make beer. So the brewery had to have a generator and the staff to maintain the generator. When the public utilities came about and they could get electrons out of a socket in the wall, they didn't need that anymore. They transitioned all those people to something else, dismantled most of the generators, kept one of them because it makes for an interesting museum piece. This is someday going to be a museum piece. I can't wait for the day. Right? Now, the people who built that, I hope, will have learned something new by then. I hope they don't string their VMs together like that. But anyway, right, it's going to change. It's going to change. You will now be constructing your data center using recipes that create customized, specialized builds on demand for the moment that you need them, on top of generic infrastructure. You will no longer be buying specialized gear for load balancers. You will no longer be buying specialized gear for firewalls. It's all white box, no label, x86, cheap stuff that doesn't matter if it breaks. And you know, I've mentioned a lot of this already, so answering some of the earlier questions. It's automate everything. You're just going to automate everything. These are the things that no matter what cloud you pick, you still need to think about optimizing. How are you going to make sure that your application scales appropriately across the provider's infrastructure? How are you going to ensure that you incorporate into your application logic to add and subtract capacity as required? How are you going to ensure that you are distributing the applications and data where they need to be at the time they need to be? How do you think about doing this in multiple places at once? So these are the kinds of, understanding these are the new kinds of skills that IT folks are going to need to be useful working in the cloud. Now, some people say, well, I'll just go work for the cloud provider. That's fine. How many of them are there? And guess what? They've got smaller IT staffs than you do. So going to work for the cloud provider is generally not an option for most of us. We need to stay in corporate IT where we are now and start getting good at this stuff, because that's what makes you a cloudy employee. So the question of where's my box is really not the right question to be asking anymore. And I hope that this very, very brief touch on the operations side, and again, I need to do more thinking about this, I think. There's lots of stuff to say. I just haven't got it all together in my brain yet that can help people overcome that natural fear that they're going to lose their job if a workload gets moved to the cloud. It really is all about people. And some interesting examples is that sysadmins are going to have to become developers. If you're a sysadmin now and you don't know what to do next, I'll tell you what to do next. Learn Python. All this stuff is automated. All of it is scriptable. You need to know some language, right? Learn PowerShell. This is what matters in the cloud. It's not about tweaking this machine, you know, this setting in this config file or this registry anymore. So infrastructure now becomes code, right? That server is a pile of software. It isn't a box made out of plastic and silicon. And I love the move toward virtualized networking too. Not SDN, okay? SDN is the protocol from south of the controller to the physical hardware. That's it. Virtualized networking, I mean, where an entire network stack, I can pick it up and I can move it over here and I don't have to do any renumbering. Every organization on the planet is one merger and acquisition away from a renumbering exercise. That's painful. But if networks are virtualized in the way machines are virtualized, it solves very thorny and challenging operational problems. And guess what? The cloud providers love this stuff. All the cloud providers are moving to virtual networks right now. And this is your new office. Right? You don't actually have to go to work anymore. You can do your work from anywhere. I stand here saying that as I walk around with now a purple badge, not a blue badge, in my pocket, coming back and working over in Building 25, because I don't like working from home. My wife and kids are noisy, and I'm sitting on the couch. They're like, oh, fix this, disposer. It's 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I'm working now. I'm invisible. It doesn't work that way, right? So I like coming back here, actually, because it's a nice place to work, and I can see some friends. And Riverbed actually does a lot of work with Microsoft anyway, so it's good to be here. But you're not chained to any one location. And if none of what I said convinces you that the cloud is useful, this one will. If you're starting a small company and you're getting venture capitalist money, they're probably going to say you can't buy hardware. Seen it a lot. That's the end of number three. To wrap up, to summarize, what does all this mean for us? Thinking back to this notion, the most important notion of the separation of creation and consumption from compute and storage does mean that really the cloud is this idea of distributed recentralization. It's not fully distributed. It's not fully centralized. It's this odd thing that doesn't look like a mainframe. It doesn't look like client server. It is a new thing. And that's my term for it. And I think it makes sense. So with that, I know we're a little bit over, but I thank you for your attention. It's been a pleasure chatting with you today. I hope you learned a lot from this. If you have any more questions or comments, you know, there's how you get a hold of me. I'm over in 25 most days if you want to stop by. I don't remember the number, but I'm in the address book, the Microsoft corporate address book, so you can find me that way. And I think you guys all have a party or something tonight. Yep. All right. So have a good time and hope to see you again soon. Thanks much.